This week on Writers, Inc.
Hope is great, but spite is better. No, it's true, though, because, like, spite is a thing that you can harbor to yourself. Like, spite is a thing that you can use. And, like, there's so many things out of your control, but you can control spite.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J.P. Reinflesch.
I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So right before we got on the air, Freda McFadden has been exposed. Like, we know who she is.
She has exposed herself. Yes.
I don't know why, but I already thought I knew this, but I guess it was just her name that was new, like her actual name.
I don't think it was a very well-kept secret.
No.
Yeah.
And I don't actually have a real name in front of me. I didn't even bother to write
Sarah
it down.
Cohen.
She's Sarah Cohen. Okay, yeah. So she's a brain surgeon in Boston, yes. The Boston area, mm-hmm. I believe it was.
But here's the breaking news. I am actually Sarah Cohen.
Really?
Okay.
So revealing that now here.
Wow.
You don't look anything like the picture.
No, you don't.
No.
Makeup, buddy.
Can you?
We were talking about this before we started recording, and, like, you know, a lot of authors go out there with a pen name. You know, sometimes it's because they, you know, wrote under their real name and it didn't work out, so they've got to try another name. Some people do it because they've got a job and they don't want their you know, coworkers to know what they're up to, which it sounds like that's the case with her. But I think what a lot of people don't think about is, like, what is going to happen if that name actually blows up and all of a sudden this is who you're known as. Yeah. It creates a lot of issues. You know, like I always pick on Lee Child, mainly, like, Lee Child's not his real name. You know, if you go to his Wikipedia page, you can see his real name. But, you know, he was writing under different pen names too. And then all of a sudden the Jack Reacher books took off. And, you know, before you know it, he's making a ton of money and he's known worldwide as Lee Child. You know, like, what do your kids call you? What does your spouse call you? What do people call
like
you in public?
That's a stage name in rock and roll too, right? Like, I don't know. I don't see a problem with it.
No, it's only a problem if you are using that pen name because you don't want anyone to ever know.
Because you don't want anyone to know. Yeah.
I guess at some point it just gets so big you can't hide it anymore, and that's probably where she felt she was.
Yeah. I understand why she would do that as a healthcare professional with what she's writing and the job she's doing. Like, maybe your patients wouldn't want someone writing thriller books operating on their brains. I don't know.
I just, the thing that jars me is she's a quote brain doctor, which sounds fake, which sounds like what you tell somebody when you don't really know what the name of the actual.
Yeah. Well, know, I didn't actually look into it. So I don't know if she's a neurosurgeon or a neurologist, but, you know, those words are long and hard to spell.
No. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
All right. Well, congratulations to Frida. And Kevin, you've got a new book out, right?
I do. Coming out, our time comes out tomorrow. So by the time this airs, it'll actually had been out for a few days, but The Love Lock Protocol, it's number 14 in my Dan Collar series. So
congrats. That's awesome.
Very excited. Yeah. Feels like I'm back. Feels like I'm back in the saddle with this book. I got dragged down a side path and beaten with some rocks and stuff for a while, but now I'm back.
Good.
I think you're referring to me, right?
No,
the co-author title.
Not entirely.
Yourself with the rocks. Like,
no, I really enjoyed everything that I did in the interim, but I missed doing my Kotler books and I've got an Alex Kane book that's about 3/4 of the way done now, and I got some other books that I've started here and there. So I don't know. I just releasing a new Kotler book is like announcing to the world that I'm back and back to my normal everyday procedure, I guess. So. Nice.
Well, it's comforting, right? It's like finding your favorite blanket or something in the closet and taking it out.
Yeah, yeah. He's my comfort protagonist. Yeah.
All right. Perfect. What is going on in the news?
In the news, nothing comfortable at all. Actually, no, this might be. So Audible to launch NYC pop-up. Audible is opening a, quote, bookless bookstore, a pop-up in New York, a physical space where people explore stories through audio instead of printed books. The three-story, quote, story house will let visitors browse audiobooks like products, listen with headphones, and attend events like book clubs, panels, and workshops, blending bookstore culture with streaming-style discovery. I love this idea.
Yeah, it's just like when you go to the music store, you know, and listen to your records or CDs or whatever media we're using on our on your headphones. That's kind of cool.
Are there still music stores?
We have one here. Yeah, it's called Dr. Disc. Shout out to Dr. Disc, and you can go and listen to the records.
Yeah. We had one here in Portsmouth at the mall, and the mall is still there. There's like three stores still open, and that is no longer one of them. Which was very sad.
Yeah.
Well, I also live not far away from Third Man Record in Detroit, right? Which is Jack White's store. And they have like actually a recording booth in there. It's very like bespoke, beautiful to go in there. Mini concerts, lots of stuff you can listen to.
Christine's husband probably knows more about the music stores in Vegas than I do.
Oh, he probably does. He is an audiophile, so he would just name them and like, you forgot this one and this one. And that's okay.
Yeah.
There's Waterloo Records in Austin is a great like vinyl shop. And I hadn't been in one in years, but we went there just before we came to Pittsburgh. We went, kind of checked it out. And when we're back in the area, I plan to go there. But I know Houston has a few music stores. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I hope they're still around. That's where we're headed next.
Yeah, I hope they still have some because I just saw somewhere online that Houston is the size of Connecticut. So
yeah,
there
and,
you go.
And growing.
The city?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Houston. Now everyone underestimates
the
Houston,
size
man.
Of Connecticut.
Yeah. It's got a population bigger than most states.
It's shocking how big Texas is. I mean, like you hear that over and over and over again, and you know that, like if you can't drive across Texas in a day, like it's just so massive. But
yeah,
it just is one of those facts that like sort of like evaporates out of your mind. And then like someone says something like that, like they're Houston is the size of Connecticut. You're like, wait, what?
I had a friend that just moved here from Oregon and she moved to British Columbia. I'm in Ontario. And our friend in Florida is like, oh, that's awesome. Can you like see each other now? And I'm like, sir, we are 2,000 miles apart. It's not a short drive. So
shouldn't that be kilometers?
Yes. But, you know, I convert for you guys. So you're welcome.
All right, it's like having a conversation with ChatGPT. All right. Next story. What nobody's telling querying writers about what's happening to publishing right now. In a post by a literary agent, she reports that the publishing industry has tightened significantly. Imprint closures, distributor bankruptcies, and layoffs mean fewer places to submit, slower responses, and more competition for every deal. Publishers are becoming more risk averse. Now, we have like four little bullets here about what writers should know right now. Should I read these?
Maybe just like quickly. I don't know. We can just put them up online too.
We'll just put these up online. They're
a
little lengthy.
It's basically just if you haven't updated your agent list, do it because it's all changed in the last year.
Changed.
Sales data is important and you need a social media presence.
You need a platform. That's the big takeaway. There you are.
You know, I always read these things and it's like, I think that sometimes like, yes, it's good information to have, but I don't know. I feel like sometimes these types of informational or helpful posts can like sometimes backfire because then you start overthinking things. I mean, people with big platforms can still get rejected for books and people with no platform can still get offers and book deals. And, you know, it's.
Yeah.
It's just so like there's not ever going to be a magic formula.
Yeah, I think the whole point was that, you know, the market is hard right now. And if you think that that's true, it is true. But like her whole point was just like, stay informed, stay curious, be intentional about why you're doing what you're doing and keep going. Like if you get a no, it's not a critique of your work. That was kind of the whole point. Market is hard. persist.
My takeaway was like, it's always hard to submit. It's always hard to get an agent.
Yeah.
And you can't dust off the same, you know, list of material you used for the last book for this book. You've got to go out there when you finish up your title, you know, research the agents that are out there right now. You know, what are they looking for right now? And, you know, curate a list that actually makes sense based on the current market. I mean, it's always been that way.
All right, our final story from Arundhati Roy's Mother Mary Comes to Me to Dan Brown's Secret of Secrets, how one man printed thousands of fake bestsellers. A man in India, not Kevin Tomlinson, a man in India, was arrested for running a large-scale book piracy operation, printing over 20,000 fake copies of best-selling titles and distributing them across multiple regions. The scheme was highly organized. He used real books to create printing plates, then produced cheap knockoffs sold at a fraction of the price, sometimes appearing almost immediately after official releases. Also, Kevin Tomlinson knows that Christine set him up with the
you did a beautiful headline. Job with that name.
I practiced before
for you.
The show.
I'm proud. He's on to your tricks, Christine.
I saw that. I'm like, oh, yeah, Christine. Pick this on purpose.
When I read this, I know I was supposed to be mad about what this guy was doing, but my first thought was, well, where did he get that equipment and how much is it? And
right.
Can I get it for myself, you know, to start printing my own books instead of using a printer and a distributor?
Well, you know, what's really interesting though, is like, cause I was looking into equipment for like brain computer interface stuff. So something that costs $5,000 here costs $100 in India. And it's like the same thing. So if you want to know where to get that equipment, I would suggest not looking in Northern America for cheap.
Joanna Penn, I'm kind of going back through some of the Creative Pen episodes, and I think like 3 or 4 weeks back is the one I listened to last night.
Yeah.
But she talked about an article that Willow Winters wrote for, I think, BookBub. And Willow mentioned that she's got her own printing press in her warehouse, mm-hmm. and she prints her own special editions and kicks them out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know...
That. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, this is becoming a very, you know, tangible thing, I think, for indie authors to look at.
Yeah.
Because I personally spend a lot of money on printing, and even with Simon & Schuster as the backbone, like I know I'm getting, you know, low dollar amounts. It's not costing me a lot, nowhere near what it did through like Ingram and somebody's print on demand places. Yeah. But this can take it to the next level. You know, you go with that. You have to spend that money straight out of the gate, but it's going to save you a ton. It's going to be a tax write off because it's a depreciable asset.
Once you've got it printed, it's the distribution that's going to be the challenging part. But
yeah, but see, all of that kind of makes sense too, because like right now, if I print, you know, I put out a book, I'll print 10, 20,000 copies of that book. That goes into a warehouse somewhere, and I get charged for those books sitting on a pallet in that warehouse until they actually get shipped and distributed out. You know, so when you start looking at all the numbers and putting it together, going out and getting your own warehouse, stocking the books there, even printing them there, all those things make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Sasha Black has that model, and she uses a local printer in the UK to get the prices as low as possible. And it's, I believe she stated this before, that it's to the point where she can compete and get the books that she has printed in bookstores because it's actually cheaper for everybody. So it's like she can outcompete herself almost in some cases. And I think that that's sort of like the way when you want to go about that business of being the one, the e-commerce or the commerce version of your author business, that you have to look into those opportunities and find the cheapest but the best quality as well.
What this tells me is that we should all band together, a bunch of authors, and buy our own print house and our printing equipment, and warehouse and everything. And then we become our own printer and distribution arm.
When I was looking to do print scale stuff, the U.S., the prices were so high in comparison to other places. And even with shipping, it was cheaper for me to do an international order than it was for anything else in the U.S. just because of how expensive it was. And it made no sense to me.
So the point is, buy American.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. All right, J.D., who's up this week?
This week, we've got V.E. Schwab and Kat Clark coming on. They're the writing team behind The Ending Writes Itself, which is about a group of authors brought together on a remote island to vie for the chance to write the ending of a book by one of the world's most popular authors shortly after he passes away. I'm not going to lie. I got like 10 copies of this book as ARCs, and I tore through it when I finally read it. It is really good. So I'm looking forward to this. V.E. Schwab and Kat Clark.
All right. So... Victoria, you said you swore you would never co-write a novel. And Kat, you had left the publishing industry for film, swearing you would never come back to books. So I want to go back to the beginning, to that warm night in Edinburgh. Who broke first, and what was the pitch?
Victoria, would you like to?
Well, so Kat and I have been friends for 15 years, and we started out, we met each other through YA publishing, and then we both left YA. It's just that Kat went farther. Kat left all of publishing, and I simply fled into adult. We both fled into industries fraught with their own problems, but that's fine. That's neither here nor there. The point is that I had an idea, a seed of an idea, for a locked room mystery. And I knew it was a brand break for me, so I'd have to do it under a pseudonym anyway. And I went into Kat's kitchen because we live very close to each other. And I basically was like, hey, I have an idea. I'm going to write this book under a pseudonym. Do you want to adapt the script? To which Kat said,
absolutely. That sounds like fun, because writing scripts is, I find it easier than writing novels, and it's quicker. And the raw material is already there. And so I was like, cool, sign me up, Buttercup. But then V came back the next day saying, no, you have to write the book with me. This is a lot of work. And so I was not keen, because I really didn't want to get back into publishing. But V said it would be fun.
Yeah. I know, to be very clear, I didn't say it would be fun the whole time. I did say that it would be fun, and it was fun sometimes. And I once heard a person say that, like, the difference between a job you love and a job you hate is not that the job you hate 100% of the time, and the job you love 100% of the time. It's just, if you, the job you hate, maybe you like it 5% of the time, and the job that you love, you like it 25% of the time, right? Mm-hmm. Every job has hard parts. And to be clear, yeah, it wasn't, to my understanding, that Kat didn't want to write with me. It was that she didn't want to tread back into publishing as an industry.
Oh yeah, it wasn't a V problem. It was a whole industry problem.
So Kat, like, tells me.
I just didn't want to do books anymore. I was done. I'd fled. And then V kind of lured me back in.
Well, because I know that you were an Agatha Christie fan. And the thing is, we're both TV and movie fans. We both have done script work. And so I was like, I could see it visually. It started out as just, we need source material to do a film from. But very quickly, as we got into the actual craft process of it, did we realize that we were incapable of phoning something in. And so we essentially just started caring immensely about the work on paper. Then the story.
I remember that moment in the garden where we were like, but what if we tried to make it good? We were like, that would be interesting.
It sounds terrible, but at first it truly was like, it was sometimes in Hollywood, often in Hollywood, it is easier to get a green light when you have source material you are adapting from, as compared to just starting out as a script. So it did genuinely started as one, a way for us to air our grievances with publishing, but two, to have something for us to work from. And so we didn't set out intending for it to be like 99.99% of our heart and soul and effort in the book. It was just as we were building the characters that we started to realize, like, oh, neither one of us is really good at doing something mediocre when we could do something great.
Excellent. And so then we have the pen name, Evelyn Clark. How did the decision to write under this pen name happen, instead of doing, you know, by both of you? And then what were the components that make an Evelyn Clark book versus your own individual voices?
What you need to know about V is that she's extremely particular when it comes to design and book covers. And so the idea of having two names on the cover, messing it up, just too much text, was just
inelegant.
Inelegant. This is someone who has like the longest book titles of all time.
But my name is short and I like the ratio. I think it looks better. But I love that question about, like, what is the difference between an Evelyn Clark voice? Because honestly, that's half the reason that we wrote it as one pen name, and we could get into the craft of like how we actually wrote it. But we wanted Evelyn to feel like a third person who wasn't either one of us. It started out as E.V. Clark, like Evie, E-V-I-E, which was supposed to be like a very, you know, very obvious inversion of V.E. And then Evie didn't have the gravitas, and so it was changed to Evelyn.
Nice. So yeah, what does make the Evelyn Clark voice? What is that in comparison to your own separate pieces coming into it?
Cat.
Well, I think it's like V's voice, but like a bit funnier.
A bit less pretentious. A bit less pretentious.
like it's like 15% funnier.
Yeah, that is actually really true. I my humor lives, like Kenzo in the book, my humor lives very adjacent to horror. Like, I like to say that you can always tell when a character is going to die in one of my books when I make you laugh, because I'm trying to get you to exhale and let your guard down so I can just stick the knife in. But yeah, I mean, it's less poetic. It's pacier. It's still, we're very proud of the wording. But I mean, it has Kat's characteristic flair, the dialogue, the wit. It moves very cinematically in a way that I think is what you get when you combine an author who lives entirely in her head and plays movies there, and an author who lives entirely on the screenplay page and has that eye for dialogue and movement.
Yeah.
And I cannot see pictures in my head, as we discovered during the writing process of this book.
Wild.
I see nothing. I just see blurry figures. There's no real images there.
Yeah.
Interesting. I see everything in such detail that I, like, my goal is to make a film play in your head that is the exact film that plays in mine, down to like the score and the color palette.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the aspects of like a good book to me is that I can play it like a movie in my
exactly.
head. But like exactly. hearing people who have aphantasia or you know, whatever version of that, I'm just like, how do you read?
Well, that's basically what I did, is I looked at Kat across the table at one point when Kat was like, can you just describe this part of the house? And I was like, well, you can describe it. And Kat was like, well, I can't because I can't see it. And then I just stared at Kat for like a solid 5 minutes. And I was like, what?
And then you were like, picture an apple. What are you seeing?
Yeah, no.
What are you seeing?
Yeah. I was like, what do you mean you can't rotate the apple in your mind and take a bite out of it and see the seam and all of these things?
Nope.
Well,
but
that's
so
really
interesting
fun.
As a screenwriter, because I remember David Levithan had an anecdote about being on set for one of his adaptations of his shows. And like he said, he was like, he had a co-writer in it.
Yeah.
And they were talking about the set of the scene, and the co-writer was like, oh, isn't it amazing to finally see it? And he was like, well, like I didn't see it before.
Right. That's really cool, though, to have like both of those aspects coming into this voice, just because that helps with sort of like the reader's enjoyment overall.
Yeah. Touching all the bases.
Yeah. So I do have to ask. So you've both said that the horror stories that the characters share inside the house actually happened either to you or someone you know. So was there a story that was particularly hard to put on the page, one that sticks out the most, or one that didn't make it into the book that you're willing to share?
I mean we both found it really cathartic, so I don't think it was never hard to put it onto the page. It was hard to decide what to leave out, because we both have so many horror stories. But honestly, I was just thinking just now that I maybe wouldn't have wanted to co-write this book if we weren't exercising all those demons from publishing. I think that really helped lure me back in, like, come back to publishing, but you can poop on it.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, is Kat and I have been really great friends for like 15 years. And the first 13 of those years involved us sitting at each other's kitchen tables, bitching about publishing, because we had just been through, Kat was an editor, she's married to a literary agent, we both started NYA, we had lots of highs and lows. Yeah, it was delightful to put on paper. And as Kat said, the only hard times were when we were like, we can't put that one. Like, one of my favorite horror stories, I cannot share, because all parties involved are still alive, right?
Oh.
And but like, in terms of my engine being fueled by spite, it is one of my favorite and most powerful like pieces of fuel in that engine. And so, but yeah, everything, I'll remember one that I gave to Millie, our YA author. And I think that she was probably the most cathartic in that respect, because she was someone who became like the fount for all of our personal demons that happen. And I think that, like, she tells an anecdote at the dinner table that is genuinely one of my most vivid memories from my debut year, which was that essentially in my debut year, I think it was like 6 Angel books were bought by the same publisher for the same sum, a very high sum. And then they essentially, the publisher waited to see which one would take off and then just slashed the supports on the other 5. So 5 authors ended up from debut in the red and essentially on things that they would almost certainly, I think of those five, I can't remember, but I think only one still writes. And just because the publisher was like, it's a game of odds, let's play odds, not thinking the fact that they would really hinder five of those six careers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those authors thought all their dreams had come true.
Exactly. That's
not knowing that it was the odds were stacked against them from the get-go.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I remember being in those like debut author chats, and those authors were just like on top of the world because they just believed that like a business had their personal best interests at heart. And I think that's what makes publishing so brutal, is that it's the intersection of art and commerce. And I think it's really important to say that like, the things that we're taking the piss out of, we're taking the piss out of systems, not people. So like within the system, within the book, we have passionate editors, passionate people in publishing who are working really hard and believe in what they're doing. And that is the case in the real world as well. It's like a systemic issue, not a personal issue here.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like those are some of like the better books to put out there, because it sheds a light on something. It holds that mirror up. And I mean, in this book, you have characters that were burned in every single way. You have mid-listers and a debut author who made some compromises. And then it sounds like you had some great people on your team. So like, were there strong pushbacks or critiques on what you had, or were there constructive conversations that came out of it?
The crazy thing is, you write a book critiquing the publishing industry, and the publishing industry just loved it. They were just like, oh yeah, it's bad, isn't it? Those people over there, they're terrible. And people loved it. The only I remember the slight pushback we had is there's a scene that V and I thought was like kind of really full of hope about writing and creating stories, and our editor said it was bleak. It was,
she was like,
and we were like, that's happier. That's us at our most hopeful. And we were like, oh, maybe we need to look at that scene again and add some, I don't know, sparkles.
In general, I think anything with inside baseball, to Kat's point, they always think, well, it's not us, like we're not the problem, which sometimes they're not, sometimes they are the champion. But it was really remarkable, because I think we imagined we'd get a lot more pushback from the people in power, considering we're critiquing the systems of power, and we did not. And we're very, I mean, so my favorite chapter, without any spoilers, is the epilogue. And the epilogue, again, is also the chapter that we got critiqued for not being hopeful. We were like, this is as hopeful as it gets. But like, it is about that kind of perseverance of the joy of the work. And it is about how even when anyone succeeds, like I'm now at a point in my career where I'm very, very fortunate. But I am also so aware that like so much of that's luck and timing. Like some of it's grit. I'm going to give myself some credit. Like Addie LaRue was my 20th book. Like there's grit, but I also know that it's timing, it's moment, it's everything else. And so I think it's like, you have to be able to appreciate where you're at and where you've come from, and know that if you're down, you could just as easily be up. And if you're up, you could just as easily be down. An author said to me very early on in my career, don't worry, if you survive long enough, everything that can happen to you will, the best and the worst. And I think you kind of have to hold on to that, which is that like, if you've had the worst already happen, or if I had a series canceled, I've had like, you know, a lot of trauma that lives in my bones from my early days of publishing. But at the same time, like I kind of looked at it at the time, like, well, great, I got that one out of the way. Yeah. Like it's not going to stop me. It's going to be a step.
Yeah. So what would be like one thing you would hope readers would sort of take out of this book?
Don't become an author. No, not that. Hold on.
That. No. If anything else makes you happy, do that instead.
Yes. The power of stories. That's what keeps us going. When the industry like beats us down, you know, we'll always be the ones who can write stories, and we can do that with or without the industry. And I think that's a very powerful thing.
I'd say hope is great, but spite is better. No, it's true though, because like, spite is a thing that you can harbor to yourself. Like spite is a thing that you can use. And like, there's so many things out of your control, but you can control spite.
Yeah. They're very different answers, aren't they?
Yeah. They are. I have to personally agree more with Victoria. My whole writing career is based off of like having to stand in front of a group of people and say, I don't want to write. And I got so mad about it that I was like, I'm going to write.
Yeah.
So I love that. Spite does a good thing.
Yeah, spite's I love great. That.
I would love to talk about the structure of the co-writing process. So it's, you know, the book itself is structured in a specific way. We've got several sections where different authors have those sort of main POVs. Did that change up the co-writing process in any way, or were you too consistent about how you wrote this book throughout?
Yeah, it didn't change it up. We didn't want to do what a lot of co-writers do, which is, you know, one of us takes the first third and fifth POV and the other one takes 2, 4, and 6. I think partly because we would have fought over some of them. There are some that are just too juicy and delicious. But also we wanted it to read consistently. We wanted Evelyn Clark to have one voice. So basically we kind of built it in layers. We kind of, V has this great house analogy, despite not really knowing how houses are built.
No,
but we basically, you know, we created the blueprint together. We plotted it out in detail together. And then we mostly sat side by side with one of us taking a first pass at one chapter while the other one was taking a first pass at another chapter. And then we'd swap and go over each other's work and then go over it again. So it wasn't a quicker process than writing on your own.
Yeah, I like to say it wasn't faster, but it was less lonely. It would have been faster if we had done a divide and conquer. But yeah, to Kat's point, we both had the same favorite characters. And yeah. Also, like, it was really important, I think, especially because my prose style under V.E. Schwab is, like, very particular. Like, I come from a poetry background. It's very easy for things to fall into, like, my voice. And I wanted to make sure that, like, that would have created a big disparity. If there were certain chapters that felt like very, very, very pointed V.E. Schwab chapters, then we would lose Evelyn.
And my chapters would have been like, there's a castle, it has walls and a door, and a man who looks like a man walks into it. That's kind of
just perfect in a script. It tells you everything you need to know. You know, the only times when we really like came to not even blows, but there was so little conflict in it. I think part because we had already been best friends for like 13 years. So we were used to each other's nonsense. The only challenge is really definitionally, I'm an American who lives in Scotland. Kat's a Scot, even though she doesn't sound like it. And but there's really different cultural humor. And like, I actually love that British humor is darker. But as an American, I fear humor a lot. And so I think finding that careful middle ground wherein we still feel like our characters are people and there's no absurdist element, but it is still satirical. Having to find that, there was push and pull around some moments where I was like, it can't be ha-ha funny. It has to be, oh God, funny. And Kat is so good at humor that I'm just like, ugh, you would be like, trust me. And then sure enough, when you built the whole scene together, it would work. But when it was like a single line, I would freak out because I'd be like, it's too funny.
And I'm like, there's no such thing.
Yeah.
Make it funnier.
So I know that a lot of our listeners have that interest or that desire to co-write potentially in the future. And it sounds like you guys had a little bit of a clash there. So how do you guys overcome those sorts of arguments or those, you know, disagreements and sort of push and pull until you find that Evelyn voice? Like, what does that process look like for this book?
I don't think it was really an issue. Like, they weren't even clashes just so much as discussions. But I heard something once about collaborating, and it's like, whoever cares the most wins an argument, unless there's like someone who's obviously right. Hi. But if, you know, some things, you know, each of us as a writer cares a bit less about. So if someone's super passionate, then that's usually a sign that maybe that's the direction to go in. So because there's not three of us, there's no like deciding vote.
I'm not sure Kat knows this, but this is one of my favorite ways to test it. It doesn't work in the first draft, but I used to do this thing with my editor where if she would give me a note and I wasn't sure about it, I wouldn't do it. And I would see if she remembered to give me the same note the next round. Now, the beautiful thing about working with Kat is that she has a terrible memory. To the point, it's hysterical because we'll be going through edits and you'll like put in a laugh. You'll be like, ha ha, this moment is so funny. And she forgets that she wrote it. And I'm like, yeah, it is funny, Kat. It was funny when you wrote it. And so the great news is it kind of makes you, Kat, kind of like a blank slate each time. But it does mean that if something is really important to you, you'll bring it up again.
Yeah.
And so I kind of use that as a little metric. Also, the nice thing about both of us is that we both really have the most respect, I think, for the best answer. And we don't have like the arrogance to champion our own point if we feel like the other answer is better. So I think we both kind of love being like challenged to come up with the best. So I think there were probably one or two moments where if we both felt strongly, we would each write our version of the paragraph or the beat of the scene. And then we just compare them and it'd be like, yeah, that line's actually better. Or this one's better. And we just talk it out. I mean, we're collaborators. We're on the same team. We're not competitors here. And so our goal is just to make the best version of the story. And yeah, I think it's a combination, like Kat says, of whoever cares most about a moment usually gets an advantage point. And then it just comes down to like, which one's best, which one flows best. We can bring in Kat's partner, Caro, for a third opinion, but also it's so subjective. Everyone's taste is so different that at the end, it just kind of has to be what we like.
Yeah.
Very nice. I think next time, maybe we should think about arm wrestling.
Yeah.
To solve any
a little
potential.
Rochambeau. Yeah. Also, we did discover our process. It's that flying a plane while you're building the plane. Like, I think we got about 2/3 of the way through the first draft before we found that blueprint framework house remodel flow where we realized we didn't each kind of have to write every single scene in its totality and then compare notes. One of us could lay down like the bullet points, the next could come in with some sentences, the next could come in with dialogue, and so there's no real one way to do it. And I have friends who love doing the POV distribution model. Just for us, I think I also knew, because Kat was so reluctant to come back to books, I think I knew that if I sent her off with just a directive to like work on a character, she'd probably never come back.
That's a really good point. You are entirely correct.
Yeah. So both of you have changed significantly over your careers. Victoria, you've been moving into that more of that literary direction. Kat, you've moved from YA into screenwriting, and now you've both stepped into crime together. What do you say to the writer listening right now who feels trapped in a lane, worried they'll lose their audience or their identity if they try something different?
Do it. Make the jump.
I was benefited by the fact that, unlike those debut authors who were each given 6 figures for an idea and then dropped, nobody believed in me that much. And like the nice thing about when people don't believe in you very much, they don't pay you very much, and then the stakes are lower, and then they don't really care when you pivot. So if you look at like the first 5 or 6 books of my career, there's a huge amount of pivoting. And I probably have the freedom to do that because I didn't feel encumbered or weighed down by expectation. But what I will say is, like, to Kat's point, do it. Like, at the end of the day, you are your first reader. You are your most impassioned reader. If you are not loving what you're doing, it's going to show. So like, I right now, ridiculously across the board, I have supervillains in like a kind of comic booky vibe. I have toxic lesbian vampires in an Anne Ricean style. I have all over the place. But like, I think my readers can tell that the commonality is just me. And a good story. So like, maybe it is a brand break. And you guess what? Not everyone's going to come with you. But for everyone that you lose that doesn't come with you to every single book, you're going to gain new people as well. And it's just going to kind of build. Your audience doesn't need to be a circle. It can be a lot of intersecting circles that have that kind of Venn diagram overlap. You don't have to, like, readers aren't Pokemon. You don't have to catch them all with every single book. I think one of the best things that an author can do, especially if they have the interest in it, is diversifying their creative portfolio. To come back to a different house metaphor, Kat knows how much I love metaphors. It is the only way that I see the world. I look at every story that I tell as a door into my house. And like, those doors lead into different rooms, but I'm the house. Yeah. So I think you just stop thinking of yourself as a single room and think of yourself more as a house.
Sorry, how many doors does your house have?
20 something at this point.
That's a lot of doors. You need to have locks on those.
Fewer than that, because each book in a series doesn't have its own door. Probably like,
maybe they should be windows.
No, because people have to come in. They can't just look in the house.
Through a window. I'll crawl through a window if I need to.
I have 5 doors in my house.
That is more doors than I would like in my house.
Well, I am designing a house. Your house would have no doors because you don't want anyone coming in.
Yes.
This is the other thing, JP, is that here's where our friendship nearly fell apart. It wasn't in the craft. It wasn't in the craft. There are things I didn't know about Kat until we did this book together. And that was the purity of Kat's love for the art. And what I mean by that.
That makes it sound like I'm a nightmare. This is purity is not a word I would ever use to describe.
You are a purist when it comes to the art. In screenwriting, there is like a fundamental divide here, right? In screenwriting, the vast, vast majority of the work you do will never be seen by anyone. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about what it is, you write a script and it's a blueprint for other artists to make work. But because of that, the audience at home is not reading that script. So you have a lot of freedom to do what you want and then to let go. So Kat is very good at writing and then letting go. I have a white knuckle grip on everything I've ever written and an expectation of an audience every time. Meaning like the idea of spending a year writing something that nobody but me sees, kind of horrible. So when our book was done and it was time to go on sub, which is routinely one of the most agonizing, agreed upon, Kat, agonizing experiences for everyone, I didn't take it well. Like I went a little crazy and Kat was like, to use a very American phrase, Kat was like a pig in shit. Mm. You were just so happy, Kat. Can you explain that?
I was so calm because the world didn't demand anything from me other than to sit. And we watched the Lord of the Rings extended edition.
You were fine with waiting.
And I was just so happy and so chilled and just like, it was all potential. Like it was either going to sell or it wasn't. There's nothing I can do about it. We're done.
I was so angry I had to leave the house. I was so
angry. You were so cross. Yeah.
Because I was bitter and I was jealous. And I was like, how? Because I think
to be fair to you, I was really rubbing it in as well.
You were so rubbing it in. When we moved on to like the second Lord of the Rings film, you were like, oh, this is so nice. And I was like, I am going to vibrate out of my skin. You go to hell right now.
That is fantastic. And it just sounds like from everything that you two are diametrically opposite in terms of writing. And that makes such a perfect, you know, unification of a voice.
Does it? Does it?
Yes, it does.
Yes. Yes, it does.
In our mind at all times.
And so I do have to ask, is there more works coming from Evelyn Clark that we can expect?
There is.
I mean, V might change your mind, but
no, there is. And I'm very proud of it because I told Kat before we finished the book that they would probably, if we sold it, it would be good business sense to do like a 2-book deal, right? Yeah. Most publishers would want that in this case. And Kat said, oh God, no. And then you walked out of the kitchen.
In slightly less polite terms.
Oh yeah. She basically,
there was swearing.
Directed at me, you should know. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. Kat left the room and then Kat came back in like 5 minutes later and you said, well, how about? And I was like, oh, I've got her. The cogs were turning. So yes, there is a second book, not unconnected to the first book, but with a different industry in its sights.
How mysterious.
Yeah.
How mysterious.
I will ask one final question that may or may not be a quote from the book. What advice would you give to writers who are struggling to break out? Or do you abide by the advice in the book and think they should just run?
I think my advice changes depending on the day. But I would say, I think the way I do it makes sense. Just focus on the thing you can control, which is the story. Like, yeah. Yeah, you have to, there's so much disappointment like and rejection in this industry. Like I think people think that you get to a certain level like V is at and that it's all just yes. And it's really not. The knockbacks come every single day. And I think you have to get that thick skin. And so just write and try and write what you enjoy.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to come up with some really
No,
like, you're
no.
just going to be like, be spiteful, be.
No, no, not at all. I agree. I agree completely. I think you, it's easy to be like, write what you love and the rest will follow. I mean, here's the thing.
It might not follow.
It might not follow, but what you will end up with, if you try to write to trend, right? So if you're like, wow, vampires seem really hot right now, I'm going to hop on that trend, or, you know, dragons seem really hot right now. Two things are going to happen. One, by the time you finish your book, the trend is over. It might not look like it's over, but those books that are coming out right now were finished 2 years ago, right? You will miss the trend. The trend, it will pass. You cannot write to trend because you can't predict the trend. But also, if you write a book for other people because you're writing to trend and you're not writing what you want to read, as Kat said, and that book does not sell, you will look at the work you've done and go, oh my God, what a waste of time. And if you write the book that you wanted to read and therefore you got to read in the writing of it, even if publishing completely screws you over or lets you down, even if it doesn't go out there and sell, you can't say, oh my God, what a waste of time, because you wrote something you loved. And I think that's the only thing you can control in this entire game is, did you enjoy writing the thing or not? Did you make it for yourself or not? You are the bullseye at the very, very center. Everyone else is the surrounding rings. So the only way to guarantee you're disappointed is to not write for yourself.
Well, yeah, that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That.
Well, Kat and Victoria, otherwise known as Evelyn Clark, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right. I need to know, do you write out of spite, joy, or something else?
Everything is always out of spite.
Spite.
Yeah.
So spite.
I take great joy in writing out of spite.
Excellent.
We've already mentioned that my personality is 99% spite. but I mean, I think it depends, right? It depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it depends where I'm at in a work. And I think the emotions can change. Some parts of it are joy.
Well, the question is, who are you trying to spite?
Or that, I guess.
Everyone who is not me.
Anyone? Everyone?
I'm trying to spite an entire industry is what I'm after. So that's why I write.
Ambitious.
Mm.
Bold. I like it.
Great.
Yeah. I don't know. Like the spite, it's sort of like, in a weird way, almost like myself. Like I'm going to prove it to myself. Like it's yeah. weird.
Okay.
Yeah. Like,
that's acceptable.
I mean, sometimes a little bit about other people, but also just like, it's less about like showing someone else and more about like showing myself, like, oh, I'll show you.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Like proving that you can do it, right? Like that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That where the whole hold my beer thing came from. Hold my beer. I'll show you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in the book, there was a lot of publishing horror stories. And I'm curious if there are any that you all have that you'd like to share.
Oh, I have a small one. Oh, go ahead, JD. You go first.
No, I was just saying, I'm wondering if that's why I enjoyed that book as much as I did, because there were so many little digs into the industry. And like, if you're part of the industry, you get them. Yeah. I'm curious to see how that's going to resonate with just regular readers.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I mean, they did it very, very well.
Yeah, it is hilarious that the publishing industry is just like, yes, we will publish this and send out massive arcs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had the hilarious one that when I was querying and I so meticulously proofread everything, but I misspelled my own name. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oops.
I did not check my name to make sure I knew how to spell my name.
Look, I've done it. Okay. Yes. I'm just going to own it. I've done it, but I've done worse. I went to a signing that I got invited to speak at a library in a high school, and I showed up and they had all the books already ordered and everything. When I started signing the books, someone asked me, you said the name of the book was The Long Land, but on the spine it says The Long Lawned. There was a typo on the spine of the freaking book.
Whoops.
That's Yikes.
So feel better, everybody. Yeah. About everything you ever did wrong.
So did you reprint the book or did you retitle it everywhere?
Yeah.
I would just change the title.
I just told him that it was Irish.
So all of us, I believe, have co-written, and we heard from V and Kat that they sort of do this like close-knit, like A-B method in a way. What method have you found works best for you?
I think it depends on the on who you're writing it with, to be honest. I mean, I think like it kind of like just the personalities. Like there's you're gonna fall into a structure. You know, like JD has a specific structure, but then, you know, with other people, it's kind of like what you're comfortable with. Like, so I think it just kind of depends on how that writing dynamic is going to work best.
Everybody's different. I mean, I've co-written with so many different people and no two projects have ever been the same. But it is important, I think, at the very beginning to figure out who's going to do what, or at least, you know, what you think everybody is supposed to do. It's probably going to evolve once you start the process and you start going through it. But I've seen people try to go into this blind, you know, like, okay, we're going to write a book together. And like one person will just write the first chapter. They teal it back to the second person. That person writes something, you know, sometimes that'll work, but you know, I think it's much better if you map out at the beginning, I'm going to do this, this, and this, you do this, this, and this, you know, figure out what everybody's strengths and weaknesses are and kind of double down on the good stuff. Yeah. And then go from there.
Yeah. I don't think they call that exquisite corpse. I don't think that is the best method. But yeah, I think you need a plan.
Yeah.
I tend to want to just write the whole first draft and then the partner can do whatever they want to do with it from there.
That doesn't sound like I'm co-writing.
That is co-writing.
That's not co-writing.
Absolutely co-writing. Because you're just writing a draft. The same as if I were writing a chapter and handing over a chapter and letting them edit that. Instead of doing it chapter by chapter, we just do the whole book. They get to go in, change what they want, take out what they want, add what they want.
Well, that's an editor, Kevin. That's not a co-author. A co-author
they're writing their own stuff.
A participant in the creative process.
You got this all wrong. This is a very creative process.
I don't think so. It sounds very Kevin, but I think that you were looking at more of a writer-editor relationship.
I don't think that's true, no.
I had a co-writer who... We would plan out the story, so we would make a really solid outline, and then he would do what Kevin's talking about. He would draft the whole first thing and maybe come to me every once in a while, but like I'd be working on my own projects and then it would get handed over to me and then I would go in and make the edits. But we were both there at the beginning,
right,
to
yeah,
really
did
form
the outline
the story
together. Like, yeah. Well, yeah, the components okay going in.
Just because I didn't say anything about the outline doesn't mean
I figured that's
have,
where you were
you
headed.
Know, you can't just be like,
we
oh,
crafted
well,
the
read
story
my mind
together. And then I just did a draft and then they fixed the draft.
Okay, that's very different from what words are important, Kevin. You should know that.
It's the exact same thing.
It is not the exact same thing.
There was just the prelude was missing.
A very important prelude.
I needed JP to translate for me.
Yeah.
But I've had that, and then I have another co-author who will write the chapter and then hand it over to me, and then I'll do the edits, but it's on the same chapter, and we'll sort of discuss as the story flows. And then I have another one who we do A-B, so one of us will write the chapter, then I write the next one, and we sort of edit each other as we move through. And like Jenna was talking about, like it's totally dependent on the dynamic you have with the person, which was why I was just curious on your guys' thoughts, just because I like hearing everyone else's process.
I've done exactly those two things as well. And the problem was always that I love the guy that I did this with. He's a very good friend of mine. We've written two or three books together, but he goes off on these wild tangents and then I lose the whole thread of the book. And so we're no longer paying attention to the outline. And so, you know, I've got nothing to base it all on. So that's why that was hard. That's why I just sort of
invigorating
started
taking, is the
it
word.
It can be kind of fun though. Like if you have someone who kind of has like you're similar, like you're on the same page, and you know, like they give you a chapter that like ends kind of on a cliffhanger, and now you have to pick it up. Like that's is very fun and challenging, sort of like a dance in a way when you do it that way.
Very improv.
Yeah, but you have to be very on the same page with that person, like understand what the goal of the book is, and you're, you know, sort of like make sure that like they're using sort of the same techniques that you would use to make it very fun and balanced. But it can be fun. It can be stressful. It can be fun.
Yeah.
Honestly, all those things are co-writing. Like every single one of them is just a different method. And if you get to that last page, you got it done and you did it together. Yeah. You know, just a lot of it can create additional work. You know, if you're not communicating and you don't have a plan, you could end up creating a lot of work on both sides, which, you know, might be part of the process too. You know, maybe you like editing. Maybe you like to have that, you know, the extra pass that you have to do on the book or whatever. But if the book gets done, you know, one way or the other with two people working on it, it's a co-author project.
Yeah.
Not according to Jenna.
All right, last question. Are you a house with many doors kind of writer, or do you have a limit on how many doors you want readers to come through?
I got totally lost when they were talking about doors. I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah, I didn't follow.
Is this the aphantasia part where you can't imagine it?
Is this like about a mental mansion and all that? And
yeah, so like the concept is like you are, as the author, are the house, you contain the stories, and then each door is maybe a different genre, maybe a different series or trope or anything. And so like, how many ways do you want someone to come into your house? Are you one that's like, you can come over here with this genre and this genre, or do you want people to sort of like filter in one way?
Funnel everybody through the front door, no exceptions. Heavy security everywhere else on the house.
I don't even have walls. That's the kind of writer I am. Come at me.
Free field for Kevin.
All the windows are open. Doors are, no doors on the hinges.
I think I would like to have a side door as well. I would like a front and side door.
But the doors are all sort of connected, I think. Like, I mean, I know, you know, JD's talked about this before. Like, you kind of have to... It's very rare for you to be able to have like that wide range. And even, you know, V.E. Schwab, she uses different names for the different genres. And even with this, you know, was well aware that she would have to come up with a pen name because, you know, your reader expectations. So I think if you can develop it, you know, that's fine. I think that most of my ideas, though, like sort of they, even if it feels like it starts out in left field, you know, like, oh, this is a totally new thing. By the time I kind of get my hands on it and like really start shaping it, it's all very much like similar, I think.
Perfect. All right. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got R.M. Caldwell coming on. Caldwell is based out of New Zealand. In addition to writing novels, he writes and directs for theater. His debut novel is called Fast and Fastidious and has been described as the Fast and Furious meets Bridgerton, which it releases in March. R.M. Caldwell.
Great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.